a beautiful Friday, Juneau afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, your host for today's show. And today we're going to be talking to John Neary from the Forest Service. He's the director at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. We'll be talking about bear safety. We'll also have a chance to talk to outgoing Chancellor John Pugh about his career at UAS. And we'll hear a profile of Juneau playwright Frank Katas. And that's produced by Scott Burton. We're going to have that, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, some music, and even more, of course, as always, here on Juneau Afternoon, right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Department of Justice has proposed legislation to Congress to improve access to voting for Native Americans. According to the National Congress of American Indians, many Native communities are located far distances from polling locations, which contributes to low voter turnout. In the letter the DOJ sent to Congress Thursday, one example shows that voters on the Duck Valley Reservation have to drive more than 100 miles to the nearest polling place located in Elko, Nevada. The legislation would require states whose territory contains a reservation or Alaska Native village to provide a minimum of one polling place for each tribe. The Alaska Native nonprofit Sea Alaska Heritage Institute unveiled its new structure in downtown Juneau recently, named after a Lake Tlingit scholar, elder, and religious leader. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
At the opening ceremony, the Angoon Yaqti dance in their regalia in front of the Walter Sobeleff Building. Davina Cole is the arts assistant here. She clutches her four-month-old baby girl tightly to her chest.
We're a young Yidi from the Taku Kwan area, and we're little wolves. She's my baby pup. So even right now, she's benefiting from the center. It's going to be really good for her to be surrounded by that and having a place to like even go and learn that.
The building is a museum for Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian artifacts, a space for cultural ceremonies, and a gift shop. It's part of an initiative to turn Juneau into the Northwest Native Arts Capital. But designing a space that could serve all of those functions and reflect the past was difficult.
When we got the responses, the designs were all very traditional.
Rosita Worrell is the president of Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and a Tlingit from the Eagle Moiety. She says the Native Artist Committee wanted a structure that was more traditionally inspired.
They don't like the word contemporary, so we wanted that kind of feel to it.
SHI sifted through submissions and picked MRV Architects. The design was influenced by the form of ceremonial clan houses with chunky beams of yellow cedar. On the main floor is a full-size replica of a clan house. It can seat 300 people and fits with tradition. Pitched roof, windowless, and built with adzed red cedar. Worrell says throughout the building process, she felt like she was being guided by her ancestors.
It was almost like they were saying to us, you know, I know, Rosita, you know, you're talking about being progressive, you want to move into the 21st century. It almost became like their space. And they said, this is where we are.
At the Walter Sobeleff's closing ceremony, the clan house was given the name Shuka Hit. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
Graduating high school students on the Navajo Nation community of Shiprock heard words of encouragement Thursday from Judge Judy. In this video making rounds on social media, the judge says coming to the community is meaningful.
Perhaps more meaningful than a high school in a big city or even in the suburbs. There was a sense that a really special member of the event was this.
A Navajo student won an essay contest, which led to the television judge traveling to New Mexico to deliver the commencement speech. Memorials and a funeral are taking place for the next few days in Las Vegas and Memphis for blues legend B.B. King, who passed away in his sleep last week. Among those paying tribute to Mr. King is Mato Nanji with the band Indigenous. Mato says B.B. King was one of his biggest influences. The band's music caught the attention of the blues icon and toured with him in the late 1990s.
It was a true honor, you know, to see him play every night. We went out and did the tour with him. You know, it was just one of the highlights, you know, my years of playing music. We did like 60 shows all across the country.
Mato says B.B. King shared words of encouragement and said to keep on making music. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, with funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
The simple bare necessities. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare.
All right, well, it took us a second to get to it, but that was the bare necessities. John Neary's here from the Forest Service, director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. And, John, thanks so much for coming up. And
thank you, Jim.
Among other things, we thought we'd talk about, as the bears are now pretty fully out, some bear safety tips for folks, and also just talk about maybe just some general stuff about what's happening with bears, and also other great things happening at the Visitor Center, of which there always are. So tell me a little bit, first and foremost, about what's happening with bear activity as you see it right now at the Visitor Center.
Yeah, so bear necessities 101.
Yeah.
Right, they're out of their dens. It's warm. Moms are wandering, looking for food. Got to feed those hungry cubs. Cubs have been nursing since, what, January or February? Or if they're yearlings, they were nursing all through the winter. So mom is really hungry right now. And there's not that much to eat. It's still early. But at the same time, there's a whole lot more to eat this year than there have been in the past winters, where the snowpack was a lot deeper. So we saw our first bears out at Mendenhall a couple of weeks ago, and they've been intermittent.
I almost would have thought earlier. I mean, it was such a warm winter.
Yeah, especially with the amount of seed that's on our cottonwood trees right now. We expected that they'd be feeding on the cottonwood a lot more than they are, and it makes me wonder, why not? Maybe there's other foods available in other places because of the lack of snowpack.
So when they first, that's an interesting thing. When they first come out of the den, their diet kind of changes throughout the season of while they're
Definitely.
Up before they den. So when they're first up, they're looking a lot of times like for grasses and stuff, right? They kind of want to cleanse out a little bit, right?
Yeah, well, whether it's cleansing out or you could look at it a variety of ways. I know there's that thought that bears haven't pooped all winter, so therefore they must be quite constipated. But as a matter of fact, I'm not so sure that's true. I think maybe a better way of looking at it is that
spend a little time in a bear den, you'll find out.
Right. If a bear could come across a dead deer, it would probably munch on it real quick, right?
Yeah, right.
Regardless of what time of year that is. But there's not a whole lot of that available, so they're going for what is, and they're looking for tender, young plants that are fairly high in nutrition and fairly low in fiber, and so they're following that food wherever it is.
So just green shoots of kind of whatever, yeah.
And where do they green up first this time of year? Right at the shoreline.
Yeah.
And so earlier on in the year, like especially in April and May, typically we have a lot of snow up high, very little down low at that time of year, so they come down and they follow that up the slope again later as the slope melts out. But this year, maybe not so much because it was melted out early up high.
So you were mentioning cottonwood, kind of those kind of tender buds of the cottonwood? Is that
the
seed, okay.
Yeah, because the male catkins are out on those cottonwoods, and they're pretty heavy laden, but we're not seeing that much bear activity on them, as I might expect.
Mm. Are they digging up, the skunkweed and stuff like that?
Might be, but that gets targeted a little more in midsummer and August when that root develops more. because they go for the root, not
right.
for the leaf, right?
Right.
What I see more this time of year is the grass, especially the young grass, as well as some of the young forbs, the vegetation that's coming up, horsetails, other kinds of plants in the carrot family, things that are out in our meadow at Steep Creek. There was a fairly sizable bear eating just this week, early on in the week, out in the meadow there.
That's cool. And then are you seeing cub activity as well?
Yeah. So that's the exciting part is when we see the females come back, wondering how many of the ones that were there last year with their spring cubs are coming back this year with their yearlings. And then, of course, which ones are showing up with their new spring cubs. And so we had early on, we had a couple of different females with cubs, and the one that caused the most attention was bear number 103, who came back with her three yearlings.
Oh, that's cool. And you've actually had some video footage that you sent along our way. Was that taken this year as well?
Yes, I took that video. Well, let me start actually
sure.
a week earlier than that video,
okay.
because that's kind of the full story, which is interesting and what eventually caused the East Glacier Trail to be closed. Because I was doing my Monday run around East Glacier Trail like I often do. And as I came up from the visitor center up the stairs and wove around the back towards the first junction to the East Glacier Trail from that side, I noticed a friend standing at the trailhead looking at her smartphone. And, hey, how's it going? And she said, oh, I just saw a bear up the trail. I said, really? Which one? She said, oh, I had these cubs. And I said, oh, let's go have a look. So we ran up the trail because she was obviously a little nervous to go up herself
right.
again. And as we rounded a corner and we were chatting quite loud, I saw a female black bear right in the trail looking at us, ears up, and then walking towards us. And then quickly saw two cubs below, and there was another cub behind somewhere that I couldn't see. And so we stopped, of course, and said, hey, how's it going, bear? And then she just kept walking towards us. So I thought, okay, let's just back up. So the two of us backed up about 20 feet and stopped. And I turned around, and she had stopped. But as soon as she saw that we stopped, she started proceeding towards us again. And so it was a very clear message
mm-hmm.
that she was uncomfortable with us approaching that family at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that was bear 103. And as I went back to the visitor center and talked to others about their interactions with this bear, we come to realize after consulting with Fish and Game that she'd been in a number of cases where she had been surprised by mountain bikers or where loose dogs that were
mm-hmm.
not on leash,
mm-hmm.
Ran up barking at her and her cubs, and she was getting pretty testy, as you might expect. And this is a bear that Fish and Game knew pretty well. It had been collared in 2013 in the fall, and she wore that collar, and so they knew her movements around the valley. She stuck to kind of the green belts, and she moved throughout the valley, though. It wasn't just a like bear number 25, who stuck to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center and Steep Creek area and Nugget Creek. This bear wandered a bit. And so we started having conversations about what to do, and they didn't really want to do much about the bear because it's a whole family, and the family's about to break up. She's going to kick them out because they're yearlings pretty soon. So the hope was that would happen sooner rather than later. So maybe if we gave her some breathing space by closing that East Glacier Trail, perhaps the breakup would happen and then everybody would go their merry way and mom would be maybe a little more chill.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't turn out that way, though. Well, what happened was the following Thursday, I went out and was just walking the Trail of Time. So we'd already had the closure in effect for several days. And I saw her again, and that's the video I sent you
right.
where it was really a pretty calm interaction for the most part. I was alone. I didn't have a dog off leash. I was watching four bears specifically, so I was being careful about how I interacted with them. But I saw her and her cubs wander down onto the Trail of Time up by that CCC shelter, the cobble shelter there. And the cubs took notice of me, and then she did. And I just kind of backed off a little bit and stood quietly and had my camera in my hand. And then she moved off to the side, but one of her errant cubs wasn't following her. And this seems to be the pattern with that bear, this one cub who hangs back, probably a male is my guess. And then she's got to figure out how to get him back with the family group to move to wherever she wants to move. And it wasn't happening quick enough, so she said a little something to her cub. He got kind of irritated, jumped up a tree. And I thought, okay, it's time for me to leave this scene because she might really get more irritated.
So that's where the video ends. I mean, with you saying, okay, got it.
I got your message.
We'll actually post that video online. And for folks who want to check it out, if you go to kto.org and check out Juno Afternoon, we'll have that link up there for you after the show. But that was a fascinating video to watch. And to me, it just gives you such respect for the athleticism of those animals, how fast they can move, and how much respect you really need to give them on the trail.
Well said. I think that the yearling cub is only stands about a foot and a half off the ground, but he jumped up the tree about 5 feet.
I mean, it was amazing. Yeah.
I wish I could do that.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it
pretty
was
amazing.
Incredible.
And then the rest of the story, sort of as it continues to evolve, is after that interaction, I was talking to Steph at Fish and Game, our area biologist here, about this, and said, you know, it seemed like she was pretty chill. She didn't, like, charge me. She was pretty much in control. And when it got a little dicey, I backed down. Maybe things are going okay here. But then right after that, we had several reports of things not going so okay as that family moved over into Dredge Lakes, over towards the Mendenhall River Back Loop Bridge. She had some interactions over there. Again, loose dogs, people on bikes happening upon them suddenly. And so she moved off. We reopened the East Glacier Trail this week because that didn't seem to be the critical piece here anymore. But the bear's still wandering. She still has her cubs, and she needs some space.
So just a great message, no matter where you are, especially Valley, it sounds like, area, obviously, that there is this bear out there. Is there any sort of idea, is there any concern for either her or the cub's health? Is there something like that that might be happening? Is she in a bad mood for some reason, or do you think it's just the very normal protective of the cub's kind of time period for her?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think it really is that she's both tasked with this any day now, kind of
teenagers,
chasing them out, right. But she's also got this one who wanders, and she's a good mom. She's trying to figure out how to keep the group together until she's ready to tell them to leave, right?
Yeah, right.
Is there still sort of her responsibility for now? So I think it's normal. But at the same time, it's really possible that accumulated stress from all these dogs and bikers happening upon them suddenly and threatening her family, and she's got three of them.
Yeah.
So she's got triple the task of many of the other bears in the area.
Yeah. So let's run through some of the just basics. I think a lot of us who've lived in bear country for a long time kind of basically understand. It's always great for a refresher. So what are some of the basics if you'd meet this bear or any bear out there on the trail?
Fair enough, yeah. So especially at Mendenhall, where these bears, most of them are used to seeing people, there's a certain set of rules that we'd love you to follow. And they're a little different than the rules in your backyard, right, where the bear might be coming in for the bird seed or the garbage or whatever. Out there, we don't have the bird seed or the garbage. So the bears are just moving through this zone. They're pretty used to seeing people because there's a lot of people that they have to move by. So mostly it's pretty much a calm down message. Give the bears just a little space. They'll figure out how to move around you. But all that sort of goes to heck when there's a dog involved, especially when the dog is off a leash. But even on a leash, because this bear in particular has seen so many dogs off leash, even a dog on a leash is pretty threatening to her. But at a minimum, at least you can control that dog on a leash and you can pull back with your dog. But if it's off leash, you know, anything goes. So that's the diciest one, is we just really hope you'll keep your dog on a leash throughout this whole zone. And then secondly, if you're on your mountain bike, realize that you might happen upon something very suddenly and be between
and
her and your cubs.
Yeah, right.
And it's not a brown bear, so she doesn't react so viscerally, right? She's not going to charge you. Most really serious incidents are female brown bears defending their cubs. Black bears, slightly less, actually quite a bit less, tend to tree the cubs and move off more typically. But this one doesn't move off so quick, and she's less likely to just do that because of the number of dogs she's encountered.
Well, let's talk about brown bears a little. As I was telling you before the show, I think I saw the rear end of a brown bear one time on East Glacier Trail. And as you said, people consistently kind of report seeing brown bears time and again in the glacier area. Any reports of that or any ideas about maybe this fairly unusual weather contributing or not contributing to brown bears being around?
Yeah, brown bears are reported to us almost every year. The typical reports are somewhere up on East Glacier Trail, normally kind of high on the slope, not so much Trail of Time area, because that's quite close to the people. And brown bears tend to stay away from people much more than black bears do, so not surprisingly, really. And yet, good habitat up Nugget Creek and Thunder Mountain, that whole area, that's not surprising that they'd be using that. Thoughts on brown bears in general? Well, you know, I spent much of my early career on Admiralty Island learning about bears on Admiralty, which, of course, are the brown versions. So for me, they don't seem any more threatening or less threatening in that sense. But they do react more when surprised, especially females with cubs. So give them even more space. And if there is a sudden encounter, expect it to be a fair amount of bluff and the female messaging you to back away and just do, right? So it's going to be more overt with the brown bears. But in terms of the weather, you know, that's a really good question. I don't think I have a good answer
for.
Yeah,
it's hard to know yet.
It
right?
really is.
Yeah.
Emergence from the den was probably sooner. You know, and I suppose the collaring data from Fish and Game will say that when they get the data later. It probably was sooner because there were more food available to the bear. Perhaps even early on, the dens were probably wetter earlier because of the lack of freeze up high, you know. So there's probably a reasonable chance that emergence was earlier. But, of course, the vegetation was earlier, too. So that might have synced up reasonably well for the animals. We might see that they have a longer season even, possibly, to get healthy. And certainly the bears that we've seen around the visitor center so far are very healthy. The cubs, for example, mm-hmm. 103's cubs. Steph wondered if they even denned up at all because they were spotted fairly late and early, and they're pretty round, pretty big for yearlings.
Yeah,
yeah. So
yeah.
They might have stayed out either all winter or at least much of it.
Mm. Well, tell me, is other stuff happening at the visitor center? We've talked about bears, and just to reiterate, folks, you know, please curb your dog, you know, and keep it on the leash, and you know, just practice good safety there. Also, mountain bikers use a little caution, and as well as hikers and runners out there.
Right.
But other than that, other stuff happening at the visitor center.
We're busy.
Yeah, I'll bet. Right, it's full on season now.
Yeah, we've survived our first few four ship days, right?
Right.
So we're going to get a lot more of that. The other exciting thing for me is just as we move towards thinking about becoming more sustainable in our operation, what does that mean? And it means problems that like transit congestion and restroom lines and problems with people just being clogged on the platforms. We're really looking for solutions to that kind of stuff. And I've been giving presentations around town about this. So there's some of that future thinking that I hope the community wants to participate in. And we've got funding to do this master plan this fall to really look at the next couple of decades out there and try to make this place everything it can be. And really a sustainability center in the face of climate change is the long-term objective out there. So what would it look like if we closed the last third of a mile and just had a circulator bringing people instead of all those vehicles? And what might that do to the experience down at the end where suddenly it's very calm instead of breathing diesel dust with a lot of stressed out people looking for where their bus is? They just go to the stop expected, and the circulator picks them up and takes them out to the remote lot with maybe there's a nice covered waiting area and restrooms and a bookstore to browse in while you're waiting for your bus. That kind of thinking is what we're trying to put in for it. And there's pie, I have to say.
There's pie?
There's pie in my vision.
What?
Yeah, I knew I'd get your attention with that. You know, the pie shop that existed in the visitor center when it was first opened in 1962?
Yes, I know it of legend.
Of legend,
yeah,
right. Well, some people remember the taste of that pie, and I hear from many people that the pecan pie was, like, extraordinary. So we hope, you know, in this vision to think about how to bring the pie back to the glacier. What does that mean?
I love it. How to bring the pie back to the glacier.
And what does it mean to the bears is another thing that we have to consider, too.
Yeah.
So we're trying to look for a balance between what the cruise visitors looking for the place, which is they think of it as a national park, and national parks have food, and they have concessions to give you the food and a nice place to eat it. But instead, right now, what we have is this food ban. And if someone shows up with a banana, we say, sorry, but you got to, you know, get back in your car if you want to eat that thing. And it's not so welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think residents really appreciate that message. They think they can handle their banana just fine. But we want a solution to that is what I'm trying to say here. And I think we could do that. I think we could maybe convert the pavilion into a pie shop and have a concessionaire run that and have fencing to keep the bears out and really think through that whole scenario.
No, it's really interesting to think about it that way. I think so many locals, I kind of don't go down there during tourist season that much, right? Because it just feels so overrun and so we enjoy the glacier in the off season when it is very calm
on Monday morning.
So it is interesting to think about that idea of it not having to be like quote unquote a madhouse in that area, and instead it being this experience that we want it to be, and that really represents the natural beauty that we're trying to preserve and represent. Yeah.
Well said. And another way that I like to look at it is that we serve both as what people would think of as a national park, but we also serve what people think of as a city park. a place to walk your dog, to ride your bike, to just walk down the sidewalk on a nice evening, to go for a hike, to just sit and relax. And there are people that come out just to people watch.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah,
it's fun. But that's what a city park serves for a lot of Juneau. And that's a pretty wide range of interests, from all the way from national to city. And we're trying to meet that by make the community feel welcome there. And to, in fact, bring things like a pie shop, expanded bear viewing platforms that allow for more ability to watch the stream and the bears, better trail links that link these different trails together, and a much quieter, less congested transit system would really be appreciated by all.
Yeah. Well, John Neary, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. The Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center is such a great resource for us here in town, and really good to know about the bear activity happening there and just the smart way to act around bears as people are walking around, not only near the glacier, but also
everywhere.
Every trail and every kind of where. Yeah, and everywhere, not just on trails. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank
really
you very much,
it.
Andy.
Okay.
This is Bird Note. It's been said that if someone knows only three birds, one of them will be the crow. It's common, easy to see, and even easier to hear. But it turns out crow voices are very complicated. Altogether, crows may use 30 different sound elements in different combinations, and one of the most intriguing is their song. Unlike many birds, crows don't sing loudly to attract mates from a distance. Instead, they sing softly and at close range during courtship, with a rich mix of soft cooing, rattles, growls, bowing movements, and mutual nuzzling. And a crow's song is particular to its social group. Studies of captive groups show that each group develops distinctive sound elements that become a kind of cultural tradition, a dialect which crows use to recognize one another. So even if someone knows only three birds, as long as one of them is the crow, there'll always be something new to learn. Bird Note writers include Bob Sundstrom, Todd Peterson, Dennis Paulson, Chris Peterson, and Ellen Blackstone. I'm Michael Stein.
Welcome back to a Juneau Afternoon. Urban life has long drawn young people out in rural Alaska, and now art is imitating Alaska life in a first-time Juneau playwright's new play, They Don't Talk Back. The debut work has caught the eye of a well-known Native American theater company and drawn the homegrown playwright to Los Angeles. Scott Burton has more.
Frank Katas describes the plot of his play, They Don't Talk Back.
It's about this young man, he's still in high school, that goes to live with his grandparents and cousin in an unspecified village in southeast Alaska. And he's learning about, you know, being Tlingit there, not necessarily like the traditions, but being raised in a city. It's implied that the city's Juneau or Anchorage or something, and he's going to a smaller village and learning how things operate there. And
Katas says his writings often explore the sometimes confusing differences between his Tlingit heritage and contemporary society. When inspiration hits, he'll compose a monologue, a soliloquy, or a poem. This is his first full-length play and is composed of several years of these writings that ride on a central theme.
It's about decisions. I mean, there's definitely a brain drain in a lot of Southeast Alaskan towns, and that was kind of something I thought about when I was writing it, is people will take off and then, you know, with the promise of returning and then never do. I mean, we even see that effect here in Juneau a lot. And I think it's one of the conflicts that the main character is dealing with throughout this play.
Not expecting much, Katas submitted his play to a leading Native American theater company, Native Voices at the Autry in Los Angeles. The theater chose Katas's play amid numerous submissions as one of three major works to present at this year's 17th Annual Festival of New Plays.
An amazing first-time playwright.
Jean Bruce Scott is the Native Voices producing executive director.
the fact that this is his first full-length play is really telling in terms of his natural talent.
Scott says the play is unique.
He's using what we're currently calling interludes that bracket the individual scenes that are happening in the play. And the interludes, each one of them is different. One may be Clinkett drumming and singing. One may be a poem. He's using spoken word.
Even what Scott calls a beatbox-like rhythmic language.
And then he's telling a very important story in Indian country, and that is the connection between culture and history and the present day, and how do Native people hang on to their children.
Katas will be in L.A. through the end of May for the Playwrights Retreat. A full company of nationally recognized directors, dramaturges, producers, designers, and Native American actors will read and critique They Don't Talk Back. Katas says playwriting is different from his usual acting.
Hasn't even started yet, and I'm nervous, which is very odd. I don't get nervous very often going on stage, but already I'm feeling like it's something that's out of my control, and I have to just, you know, trust the ensemble, which other playwrights have obviously done with me.
It's ironic that Katas is leaving Juno himself, but that irony is not lost on him. He plans to bring back all that he learns and share it with aspiring playwrights here in town.
Maybe I'll write something else someday.
In Juno, I'm Scott Burton.
Support for this station comes from Alaska Canopy Tours, offering canopy and zipline tours. More information at alaskacanopy.com.
This October, voters will elect assembly and school board members. I'm Karen Crane, now in my second term on the assembly, and I'm inviting you to come to a free workshop on how to run for office, sponsored by the League of Women Voters and CBJ. It will be held on Saturday, June the 6th. You can register at junolwv.org. That's junolwv.org.
Well, welcome back to a Juno Afternoon, and that music has a lot of meaning for my next guest. You've been through a lot. You've heard that music more than anyone else in Juno, I would say.
27 times. 27 times, Sam, three, because Sick and Ketchikan as well.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah.
UAS Chancellor John Pugh is with me, and sad to say, outgoing UAS Chancellor, but I think that you would say it's a happy time for you as well to sort of make this transition.
It's a happy time, and I think we have a smooth transition. I'm very pleased that President made the determination to hire Rick Caulfield, who was the provost for the last 5 years at UAS, and I think that that's going to make a big difference in terms of smooth transition. Obviously, have to look for another provost, but at least at the top level, have somebody who's knows Juno and, you know, and has some roots here. His sister's been here for a long time, Jan Caulfield, and, you know, and he started here in Southeast with the Park Service over in Glacier Bay, and you know, as a ranger over there. He met his wife there, married in Glacier Bay, and so really has a great love for Southeast. So I think he's going to be a really good fit.
Great. So your confidence is the future of UAS is in good hands.
I definitely think it's in good hands. I mean, obviously, this has been a nerve-wracking legislative session. You know, this is our second year where we're going to be with a little less funding than we need to maintain the levels that we've had in the past. So we're having to make some shifts in what we do at UAS. We have to focus a little more, make sure that what we're doing, you know, we pick the kind of the top programs, the quality programs, keep those going and keep funding them and giving them right amount of resources. And then looking at some of the other ones that we've been doing, but maybe we can't do in the future. So I think that's been it's made for a tough year this year, but I think we're prepared for dealing with this downturn in the budget. And I feel good about that as a lead.
And you've seen that sort of a year before. Take me back a few times.
Yeah.
So tell me about this time right now when we're hearing so much about the budget and potential budget shortfalls. Right. And what are some other time periods that you remember in your 28 years? Is that
28 years,
28
there,
years there?
Although right before I came to the University of Alaska Southeast, I have been the Commissioner of Health and Social Services when oil dropped to $8 a barrel. And, of course, that was when Governor Bill Sheffield immediately called for a 10% cut across the board in the middle of the year, in fact, as a kind of an emergency measure. So I certainly had to deal with it then and kind of calm the waters out and visit a lot of our branches of health and social services to try to get people to understand it was a temporary situation and just need to deal with this and keep providing good services to citizens of Alaska. And I think that's somewhat the same kind of thing. Now, we also went through this in the 90s, if you remember. So this is really the third time that this has happened in the last 30 years. And so, again, I think given our size, University of Southeast, we're better able to really kind of turn on dime. I'll often call ourselves the Lund of the University of Alaska system for all the folks out there. And I feel like we can turn a lot quicker than the big old battleship at UAF and the cruise ship at UAA. So,
well, it seems to me like the university system in general, and UAS specifically, has been on a really good run for like the last 10 to 15 years. The Egan Library, there's facility changes that have happened. There's increase in the amount of students that's happened, increase the amount of programs. Just tell me a little bit about some of those things that you maybe see as accomplishments that have happened in the past 20 years.
Well, since I have been at UAS, 1990 was when the library came aboard. And the library, of course, was at that point in time around $12 million building and really anchored, Marshall Lynn had brought that in, the planning and so on. And Jim Duncan was the senator who really was pushing for the university to have a strong university here in Juneau. And that was really sort of the first kind of permanent building. We had all these wooden buildings that, you worried a little bit that they could disappear at some point. And when we built that library, it was there to stay. Beautiful building and just, the right kind of anchor for a learning center. And so that in 1990 sort of set the stage. And then from when I was, we kind of in the 90s then went through a period of time where we didn't get much money. So, but then when I was appointed in 99, things began to get a little better, particularly with President Hamilton. So in 2002, we were able to finally add the Egan Classroom Edition onto that library building, and that was really made a difference. We had a lot of temporary classrooms or in trailers, basically, echo trailers, where we were doing a lot of our classes and so on. So that made a huge difference. And so then over the next few years, we actually were able to get both new buildings and remodeled buildings, around $65 million worth of construction that went on in the time since I've been chancellor. And it's made a huge difference in terms of what we can do at the university and what we can provide for students.
Talk about that a little bit, because it's one thing, because you drive on the campus and you can see the obvious difference, but of course, it's a place of learning, and that's first and foremost. Yep. And so how is it that facility fits in your mind with the experience of learning?
Well, I think that the first place is that having your classroom buildings right next to your library, and we have a learning center in the library for tutoring, for helping students out, supporting. We have our technology program right across the street. We have technology support. So kind of in that square where we have all the supports for the student that we need right there. The one thing we didn't have that I'm most kind of proud of in recent years is the housing piece. We have freshmen. We did build some freshman housing, Banfield Hall, up on the hill. But that's still 3/4 mile to a mile away to walk down. And for new freshmen, it was a tough kind of situation to support them. And the leadership team came together. We had been planning to expand our housing. We needed more housing, but do it up on the hill. We actually had asked the legislature for money to expand housing up on the hill. And suddenly, in the middle of this, our leadership team said, if we're going to spend the money, we should build some freshman housing right on campus, right across from classroom building, where we really can support these freshmen coming in and provide the kind of things that they need. So
it's so intimidating to come in as a freshman. Yeah. You're in, you know, the first time away from home often, and then to and maybe they're coming in, especially if they're coming in from out of state. So then you have to walk through the wilds of Alaska to get to class,
exactly.
You know.
In the rain.
Yeah,
of Alaska,
in the rain.
In the fall,
yeah.
In the pouring rain. But, and also some of them, you know, some of the students aren't as, you know, active, and that kind of gave them excuse to sit there, you know, in the dorm and so on and not engage. And it's harder for faculty to engage with them with up on the hill. So we ended up making that decision, and we started that planning in 2010. We finally were able to complete that facility in August of 2014. I shouldn't say complete because we moved the freshmen in while we were still constructing it. We still had a lot of work to do on that. In fact, still have a little work going on it, but we just felt like we had to have it, and it really did make a huge difference. And we had the highest retention rates we've ever had, 72% in the last year of our freshman students. And it's coming from this support that we're building for freshmen. We have a first-year experience program, you know, so that we work with them, not just in their academic, but holistically about wellness, about leadership, and the kinds of things that they need to do to be better citizens. And again, it's been remarkable. The staff have worked hard to make the freshmen a real program that surrounds them and make sure that we can have them be successful.
Are there areas of study? Now, the areas of study have also expanded quite a bit since in the 28 years that you've been there. Well, I want to back up one second. Just if you could just quickly do a little timeline. So you came to the university in 87, but in a different position. And then tell me a little bit about the different positions.
So I came to the in 87 actually as the ongoing about the budget cuts in the budget year for 88, fiscal year 88. We still had a huge cut from the legislature, $1 million out of a $12 million general fund budget. And Marshall Land hired me under contract to make a report to him to go through, review what UAS, you know, what programs, what services they had, and to make a recommendation on how to cut $1 million. It was not a fun task at all. That's how I started. I kind of
made lots of friends.
I thought that was going to be the end, but exactly because I said that to him. I said, I hope you're not expecting me to be able to work here after I do this. So, but as it turned out, I was able to look at it and save most of the programs. We did cut student services a little deep. If I had to do it over again, I might have changed some of the things I did. But that was how I started. And then in the fall, our dean of arts and sciences left to go to become commissioner of education. And Marshall said, boy, you're here. Why don't you just walk in as acting dean of arts, science, and education, and we'll see how that goes. And in the spring, the faculty went to Marshall and said, we don't like direct appointments, but however, we think he's doing a good job. He knows how to manage. We need a manager, and I was appointed as Dean of Arts and Sciences.
That's
so that's
it.
How
yeah.
I started, and that's, I think, some of the hardest and work that I did and the most important work. Well, one of the first things that I did is work on revamping our School of Education, what's now called our School of Education programs. We went to Master's Art of Teaching for secondary, worked on that, ultimately Master of Art of Teaching for elementary, and which was really important, you know, because it upped the quality of our products and around the state. We got a good reputation all over the state.
So many people have gone through that I know, and it seems like such a valuable program and a ton of work.
It's a ton of work, and the thing is, you're expecting people to come in with already having a content area. You know, they have a degree in English or math or biology, so that they already have a teaching area. What we do then is throughout the year, teach them how to teach them, you know, technology skills, educational technology skills to enhance their teaching and learning, you know, at the in the schools and that kind of thing. But they're out there all year. I mean, they're placed in an internship the entire year. And that was one of the – we were the first program in the state to do that kind of program. And it's worked out really well. Other places have it. But it wasn't first in the country. You know, I was able to look at models around the country when I recommended it to the faculty. And it's been one of my one of the things I'm really proud of.
Real hallmark.
Yeah. And now, of course – with our deans of education in the last few years since I've been chancellor, we've been able to bring back the special ed program. We've been able to bring back our principals program. We have a cohort of principals every year. And now we've become the only superintendent's program in the state. So we do all the education for the certification of superintendents. And so we have the full range of education programs, which we had lost in that 87 downturn. They had transferred, the board had actually transferred a lot of programs to Anchorage and Fairbanks in this sort of merger of programs and stuff. So we really are, our School of Education's really became, you know, sort of a top-notch School of Education. Our Dean Lowe, Deborah Lowe is really, really good and on top of it. And they're known for their quality all over the state, and it's really important. The second thing we tackled was, when they had reorganized, they had taken the fisheries program away from the University of Alaska Southeast and moved it to underneath Fairbanks. And when they did that, they took all our science faculty, basically, that were teaching the biology, chemistry, everything. And so one of the first things I had to do is rebuild our science programs. You can't very well have a really strong university of, liberal arts and science when you don't have any science. So we had to really rebuild that program. And what we focused on was developing the marine biology program. And we brought in a couple new biology faculty, and that was something that we were able to do by closing down our music program. So it's just one of these things where trade-off, but we had just very few students in the music program, so really a good thing to do at the time. It's hard to have a high-quality music program without a lot of faculty in all different areas, different instruments and voice, and we couldn't really survive with what we had. So it worked out real well, and we did the marine biology program. And then later we were able to develop the environmental science program, again, working primarily in the area of glaciology and hydrology, which really fits with Southeast. So we built some of those, residential programs that really work very well here. We continued to our Bachelor of Liberal Arts, which still remains as sort of a key in the liberal arts and science area, because we get a lot of transfers. A lot of people move to Juneau to work in the summer and go, wow, I want to stay here. They have a year or two, transfer in. The Bachelor of Liberal Arts program is flexible enough to really bring in students from other areas and so on. So we get some students who come directly in that. We get a lot of transfers into our Bachelor of Liberal Arts. And then over time, we've developed bachelors in social science and bachelors in math. We have some really good math students graduating and going. Some of them going on to grad school. Some of them going into teaching. So it really has developed a lot in terms of that. And then our business programs, they're pretty much the same as when I came here. The programs themselves had some tweaking in their emphasis there, but what's so important about them is they went in when Robbie Stell was the provost, and years ago we were asked, could we do distance delivery? This is in the 90s. Could we start a distance delivery?
I remember the days, yeah.
And suddenly we were the first ones to do a program around the state. And that they do a great job of delivering their bachelor's in management, and then later added their bachelor in accounting, which is the most popular program of all our distance programs around the state. And it just keeps growing and growing. Mm-hmm. Accounting program. It's a big need in the state and, all communities. And so we broadcast, we're out there e-learning to all the rural communities as well as Anchorage and Fairbanks if students can't fit their schedules in and want to do that. So the business program real good, and then our master's in public administration over there has really grown and well known. And we have over 120 students in there. We had 24 graduates this year for small university, pretty significant. So that's been really important. And then finally, I think the thing that a lot of people don't know, we have this broad mission. In 86, when the Board of Regents made the determination to close down the community college system, we took that all on. You know, we unified it. Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan became one university. And it, when we say comprehensive, we mean comprehensive, all the way from certifications to graduate programs. And so we have expanded and improved our career technical programs all throughout Southeast Alaska and in Ketchikan and Sitka and Juneau. You know, we try to emphasize what's important to those communities. In Ketchikan, we emphasize marine operations and shipbuilding, you know, which they have a big shipyard there. You know, they also help with the bachelor, the Associate of Arts and the Bachelor of Liberal Arts distance. But, you know, and they do those career programs really well in Sitka. They have two hospitals. They do health science, you know, and they do it distance as well. And then they also do law enforcement connected with the Trooper Academy there. They have an AAS in law enforcement, and which will fold into the bachelors at both Anchorage and Fairbanks. So I think it's been really good, the development, that try to serve communities, serve a region, but also, you know, serve the state, because we're small in this region and the university might not survive if it didn't reach out to others and provide some quality services.
Your day-to-day life is dealing with the details of getting these programs done. But now, as you're kind of winding down, you're coming up in your last week there. Can you believe it? Right?
Hard
but
to believe.
Yeah. Have you had time to, or could you now look ahead in 10 years, look ahead in 20 years, and sort of envision what you would like to see UAS to look like, what you would like to see it envision, what you think about the importance of having UAS be a powerful, you know, self-sustaining institution in Alaska?
Well, I think that a lot of it is focusing. I think we have gotten to focus on most of what we ought to do. The one area I would say that I'm still a little disappointed in is we have not been able to figure out exactly what the state needs are. Except we provide a county tech program, and they do, you know, obviously hire accountants and so on. And Masters of Public Administration certainly works for folks who already have a degree. But what is, there's a huge workforce in there that we, being the capital city and being right here, we need to provide. And I don't know that we've been able to really sort of work together with them to do that. On and off, UAS has had some really good working relationships with, and I would hope we again take some time to try to look at that as what are the programs that they really need. You know, the Bachelor of Liberal Arts, they hire a lot of our graduates. In fact, a recent graduate survey showed that most of our Bachelor of Liberal Arts graduates go to work for government. And because most of them have really good communication skills, critical thinking, that kind of thing, and that's what they're looking for. But is there something we could do more to strengthen that and do, you know, some work with them to do better? Education, we just need to continue to serve the whole state and continue to improve it. I don't think there's any additions in there at all. There's been talk about having a statewide doctoral program, which would be nice to have in the state that all three universities would be a part of. With the budget down, you know, downturn, I'm not sure that would happen. It would be good to have that, and it should be one that would be statewide. And you could, there is a lot of educational research that doesn't get done in this state, looking at, you know, learning styles, looking at how different ethnic groups learn, those kinds of things, and what do you do with delayed learners or ones who need more help, those kind of things. And so there's a lot that we could do if we had a doctoral program here and had more research capabilities in that area. So I would say that's important. Business and so on, one thing we would be looking at is possibility of a master's in accountancy, maybe. That's something that's becoming very popular across the country, because for CPA exam, you need extra credits, you know, above your bachelor's. And some places have started, instead of an MBA, truly a master's in accountancy, and it's something that we're already beginning to look at and we should do, you know, over time. I think that's very important as we move forward. Fisheries is the other area. I think we should have an undergraduate fisheries program, and we're trying to bring that back now. We got a position for the next 3 years to begin to build that program and work with UAF to have a joint fisheries program on the Juneau campus. We used to have a pretty good program with 20-25 students in it when I first came, and I still think this is the best place for an undergraduate fisheries program in the state. So we're doing a lot in fish tech, and that's run out of Sitka. I forgot to mention that. And they're doing stuff all over the state in the coastal communities for the kind of the technicians that work in the hatcheries and work, you know, for the CDQ companies and so on. But I think we need to have bachelor degree folks that can go on and work in fish and game and, you know, ultimately, mm-hmm. you know, get their master's and move up. So I think those are things that we need to look forward to do. The other thing I think that we need to grow is there are a lot of career and technical jobs in this state, and our students in high schools and stuff don't know enough about them. I mean, mining pays well, construction pays well, you know, electricians pay phenomenal, plumbers pay phenomenal. I mean, these are jobs that students ought to know about early on in case they're interested in it, and we ought to be helping them to get into it. So I think that's improvement that the whole system could do to make sure that we meet the, you know, the needs of the employment needs of Alaska.
So what do you do as an overall philosophy? What do you think is the, and as we talk about, we're struggling with a budget kind of crunch right now. What's the overall value? And what do you believe the overall value of a strong state university system is to a state?
Well, you know, what's interesting, if you look down south, as people have these downturns, you know, some of the states really decided, well, let's turn to our university system and add resources because we're going to have new innovative ways of dealing with our economy and, you know, bringing in new kinds of things and, you know, and taking the industries we already have and upgrading them. Well, that takes education. It takes people can think critically, problem solve, and do that. So I think that I hope that this is kind of a one-year kind of downturn and we kind of stop the slide next year, because I do think a strong university system can provide that pool of really good students who can help to bring Alaska, you know, into the, you know, the end of this century and the next century. And I was really proud at graduation. You played the graduation music. 8 out of our 13 top students, you know, each program picks a top student. 8 of them came from Juneau Douglas High School and graduated from here and are planning on staying here and contributing. So, you know, the thing is those states that have really strong public, you know, university systems, they have good pools of ready people to move into the employment in the various fields. And they also have some research areas and stuff where they can think of changes and new, you know, new economies, new things the state can do and so on. And I think that's going to be real important to have a strong, you know, right now up at Fairbanks, they've been working on the UAVs or the UAS, you know, unmanned aerial systems. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's got a lot of juice for Alaska because, you know, we use, you know, helicopters are very expensive to use for a lot of the things that we do. And a lot of people have stopped doing certain things because they can't afford the, you know, the helicopter time. Well, a lot of them can, you know, unmanned aerial systems can do the same thing for research. The packages that those things can carry are amazing. Well, there's an example where, you know, that would be foolish not to continue. And the legislature, even in this downturn, recognized that. The Senate added money to continue that program. That was smart. That's the kind of smart thinking that we've got to have in a lot of areas in the state as we move through this.
Well, outgoing Chancellor John Pugh, thanks so much for your contribution to the smart thinking that happens here in the state. Pleasure talking to you, and good luck. And do you have a next plan?
Well, we're going to Ireland in June.
Okay. That's good enough.
Okay.
Outgoing Chancellor John Pugh from UAS. Thanks so much, John.
Thanks.
I want to thank my guest today on Juneau Afternoon. That's it. We're going out to All Things Considered next. Thanks so much for listening.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.